I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. When Dr. Blasey Ford testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee about being sexually assaulted by Brett Kavanaugh when they were teenagers, she described her experience in vivid detail, although there were holes in her memory. Kavanaugh denied her allegation, now sits on the U.S. Supreme Court, and President Trump told reporters he was 100% sure it was not Kavanaugh who had attacked Blasey Ford. Even though the story is now in our rearview mirror, there are leftover questions, including how does the brain process danger and trauma? And of course, many are left with raw and unsettled emotions about their own experiences with assault. We begin today's show with the brain and memory. And joining us from the studios of Harvard University is Jim Hopper. He's an independent consultant, teaching associate in psychology at Harvard Medical School. He's also a nationally recognized expert on psychological trauma and writes the Sexual Assault and the Brain blog. Jim Hopper, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Is the brain hardwired to process assault or attack or even danger in a very specific manner?
Yes. Our brains have been sculpted by evolution to respond in certain ways to danger and attack. And that includes really ramping up what we could call the defense circuitry of the brain, which is always scanning for danger. And when it detects it, it can take over and dominate brain functioning. And that, in turn, has huge effects on how the circuitries of memory work.
Let's walk us through, I guess, the brain. Of course, that you know, under adverse circumstances, a person is going to experience stress. Walk us through, I guess, the prefrontal cortex, then to the amygdala, and then to the hippocampus.
Sure. So, you know, all the time when we're having experiences like we're having right now, we're noticing some things and not others, and the things that we're paying attention to and the things that have significance are what's getting in and more likely to be remembered. And in a situation like this where we're not that stressed, it's our prefrontal cortex, that rational part of our brain, that is guiding where our attention goes based on the task we're trying to accomplish, based on our goals for the situation. But when we're under attack, things really shift, and the prefrontal cortex is rapidly impaired by this defense circuitry that hits it with chemicals that impair it. And then attention is governed by where that defense circuitry is focusing for survival and coping moment to moment. And at the same time that that's happening, it's shifting how the hippocampus works so that the hippocampus is really burning in the central details, those things that get attention, that capture our attention, and that have significance for our survival moment to moment. That's really what gets burned in. And the peripheral things that we're not really noticing or that don't seem to have survival value moment to moment, they're not getting processed, they're not getting encoded, and they're not going to be stored away.
And why not? And I'm thinking, I mean, one of the reasons we wanted to do the show was we just felt there was so much left over to discuss from the Blasey Ford Kavanaugh hearing. Again, she described recognizing, as she said, Kavanaugh's face, but she didn't know how she apparently got to the party, how she left. There were clearly holes in her memory. Does that tell us something then about the hippocampus?
Yeah, so, I mean, some of the things are fairly intuitive, right? So this idea that we pay attention to and we remember things that are significant to us, that's pretty intuitive, and that distinction between the central details and the peripheral details. But there's also what we call time-dependent effects of stress on the hippocampus. And those are maybe a little less intuitive. And when there's that phase that I just talked about earlier where the hippocampus goes into the superencoding mode, but it's still only superencoding the central details. But then there comes a time later where the hippocampus goes into a minimal encoding mode where it's really not taking in much of anything. And part of this is the hippocampus protecting itself against some of the chemicals that it takes in to go into the superencoding mode. And also, it's also so it can prioritize storing away that stuff that was right significant in the midst of it. So some of it has to do with time and how the hippocampus changes over time, and some of it has to do with just ramping up that central versus peripheral. And so, you know, certain things about the party before she was attacked would not be very significant and not be prioritized for storage because they're not really about survival and coping like the other things were. And then in the aftermath, after she left the party, her brain could be in a mode, likely was, where it's just not taking in much at all.
As you're describing that, and it's really illuminating in so many different ways, I'm also thinking about how eyewitness testimony or accounts are notoriously unreliable. What explains, do you think, the difference?
Yeah, so in the eyewitness testimony, those are typically crimes that are committed by people you don't know, right? So you're held up at gunpoint, or you're involved in, you know, you're witnessing a bank robbery or something like that. And there, you know, you're not taking in necessarily the person's face. You might be focused on the gun that they're pointing, or the bloody person who they've already injured or something like that, for the reasons I described before. Mm-hmm. But when we're assaulted by someone we know, that's a very different situation. So our brains have evolved, you know, our primate brains have evolved to very rapidly recognize familiar faces. Literally within 200 milliseconds, we recognize the face of a familiar person. So recognition is very different than encoding something that we're not paying attention to. Recognition of a face we know is totally different from the eyewitness testimony literature about encoding something new that we may not even have noticed or paid much attention to. So it's completely different.
I'm trying to imagine then this experience from the other side, from the side of the perpetrator. We'll call that person that. How does the memory work from their perspective?
Well, that can depend on a variety of factors. So, of course, alcohol appears to be involved in this situation. But even without alcohol, the same principles apply, that we remember things that were significant to us that we were paying attention to. We also tend to remember things that have a negative emotional significance to them over positive, again, because of their survival value. And so if someone who perpetrates a sexual assault against a person is not particularly distressed and they find it funny, then it might not be that memorable of an experience to them. But if you have alcohol on board and they're in a blackout state, and blackouts tend to come when people are suddenly having their blood alcohol level go up. So if someone is just pre-gamed when they arrive at a party, then their alcohol level in their blood and brain may be going rapidly up. And so that could account for whether the boys who assaulted her, and she says it was Brett Kavanaugh and Mark was there, Mark Judge was there, that they may have been in a blackout state. And then in that state, they're not taking in information of any kind in terms of what we call explicit memory, their ability to remember what they were seeing, hearing, and things like that. So in a blackout state, you wouldn't expect the perpetrator to remember it later.
Based on what you just said then, and you know, millions of us witnessed that that hearing and the testimony from both sides, can we say that we believe her or we believe him?
Well, I mean, certainly people are coming to it with lots of lots of preconceived views and lots of and political identities and things that can shape their thinking. I think another question is, you know, can we believe that they believe what they're saying, and that he may really believe he didn't do it, and you know, and be completely honest in that, even if there was a fuller investigation, for example, that showed that he did do it. Definitely, people can believe that they didn't do things, even if they did. Right. And there was a really interesting piece in the New York Times called Kavanaugh and the Blackout Theory, where a writer talks about how it may be that he might have done it but not remember it as an explicit memory. But what we call an implicit memory could be there, a sense that something went wrong, that something bad happened, something not good went on in that room or at that party. And that's a way that sometimes people can remember things without really remembering them. And in fact, a lot of trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder is people getting triggered these implicit memories.
Right.
And they don't even realize they're getting their trauma triggered.
Because I would assume to have a trauma triggered, you begin to relive the trauma that happened.
Yeah, well, sometimes you just relive it in your body, though. You feel that anxiety, you feel that fear, but you don't attach it to images or sounds that were associated with the trauma or even the recognition. So there's people who have been sexually assaulted as teenagers, and now 20 years later, they're trying to make love to their partner, and they're getting triggered, and their body is reacting, and they're shutting down and disconnecting. And it may be because of that old trauma and the impact it's had on them, and the memory that's in these body systems and the body parts of their brain that process that. But they may not remember, oh, yeah, I'm doing this because I was sexually assaulted. So there can be a real disconnect between what we call these implicit memories that are felt in the body and activate the heart and everything, and the explicit memories of the images and sounds and the stories we tell ourselves about things that happened to us.
There was an FBI investigation, although neither Blasey Ford or Kavanaugh were interviewed. And I'm curious, as someone who, in a sense, does this for a living, Jim, what questions would you have wanted to ask if you could have talked to them directly?
To them? You know, I mean, I train investigators on how to interview victims. I actually don't train people on how to interview people who have been reported to have committed crimes. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't really want to hold myself out as the person saying how
Fair
to
enough.
question them. But what I would say is that a much better job could have been done of questioning Dr. Blasey Ford. There could have been a whole series of questions about what she experienced in that room and what she may have noticed on the face of, she says it was Brett Kavanaugh doing this to her. She talked very clearly about looking into the eyes of Mark Judge and imploring him with her eyes to stop it, and him not reacting in a way to stop it at that time, and how horrifying that was to her. And she may have had a whole variety of memories like that to report about Brett Kavanaugh's face that were never brought out and were never in the hearing or in an FBI investigation because she wasn't questioned. But I don't know. But that's I don't know if she would have had a lot of memories of his face, but
right.
She might have.
Right. I mean, these are, of course, the unanswered questions from all of that. Let me quote something that you wrote in your blog. Ignorance of how memory works is a major reason why sexual assault is the easiest violent crime to get away with across our country and around the world. And I highlighted that because I thought it was such an important thing to talk about because, in a sense, here we are. Again, you know, talking about something, we were not there. All we have is the testimony that we heard, and we're left with the fact that, in a sense, he was believed, she was not. He's on the court. She went home.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, it might not be so simple. It might be that some of those Republican senators actually did believe her, but felt that it was long ago. It was something he did as a teenager, and he shouldn't. You know, he's done a lot to support women in the meantime. I mean, that was definitely part of the narrative. So I don't know what was in the minds of the Republican senators. I'm guessing that some of them may have believed he did it. But this issue, you know, that quote you had from my piece about the easiest violent crime to get away with. I mean, one of the reasons is to assault someone in this way does cause these impairments in memory. And it can make it almost the perfect crime because you put into your victim things that are going to undermine their credibility as long as people, and you know, that includes defense attorneys and others who are trying to protect the perpetrator, as long as they can get away with saying, oh, you can't believe her, or you can't believe him because there's these gaps. They can't remember how they got home from the party, things like that. We know from the science that that doesn't tell us anything at all about the credibility of those memories or that person. And yet that's what makes it very easy to get away with, is that people are able to say that to juries and in the court of public opinion, and it works. And, you know, that's one of the things a lot of us around this case were trying to say, not so fast. You know, there's a lot of science showing that it doesn't work that way.
Well, Jim, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Jim Hopper. He teaches, he's a teaching associate in psychology at Harvard Medical School, a nationally recognized expert on psychological trauma. I mentioned his blog. It's called The Sexual Assault and the Brain. And we have two guests who are waiting in the wings and we will carry on this conversation. And we want to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499, especially if you have leftover feelings from that testimony and the hearing. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. While the Blasey Ford Kavanaugh hearings were less than 2 weeks ago, the news cycle has moved on, leaving many unresolved issues. I'm betting that you have talked and maybe argued about the testimony we heard. Maybe that testimony has dredged up difficult memories for you. The therapists that I know all describe how their female and male patients use their sessions to try to process the allegations of sexual assault and the denial. And as a society, we have been here before with competing narratives. What would progress look like? As I mentioned, Jim Hopper staying with us for the rest of the hour. Here with us in our Philadelphia studio is Marla Gold. She's Dean Emerita and Professor of Health Management and Policy at Drexel University. She has spent her career focused on social justice issues and population health. Marla Gold, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here. Thanks, Marty.
You're very welcome. And also with us is Esther Cherney, and she's an assistant professor of community and trauma counseling at Thomas Jefferson University. She's a counselor with a private practice in Jenkintown. Esther Cherney, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Esther, let me begin with you. You have a therapy practice. You have patients. What has this last 2 weeks been like for them, or maybe even more than that?
Yeah, it's been very, very heavy. Clients have
some of my clients have tried very hard to stay away from the news cycle because it is so very triggering. But many of them find that that's very hard to do. It kind of seeps into their experience and into their existence. And so I've spent a lot of time with clients working around being actively triggered and also kind of struggling with depression, hopelessness, feelings of hopelessness related to the fact that this outcome was, in their mind, not a positive outcome. Christine Blasey Ford was not believed. She was victimized in many ways by the hearing process. And so that's very discouraging for victims out there who are survivors of sexual assault.
Maybe identifying with her in a certain kind
Absolutely.
Of way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
How about for you, Marla? What have been your thoughts over the last couple of weeks?
Yeah. I think there are many angles to what took place. I mean, we heard about memory. We can view it certainly as an individual issue with reports of abuse and sexual assault. We can debate the role of memory and trauma. But as a public health expert, I believe that Dr. Blasey Ford's testimony and lived experience represents the lived experience of a majority of women in this country. So,
meaning they've been sexually assaulted?
Meaning somewhere on about 80% of women actually have reported some form of abuse. So it's broad, physical, sexual, bullying, harassment. I don't mean to equate rape or sexual assault necessarily with harassment on the street, but I do think we are all in our lives under a cumulative amount of what we call in public health toxic stress. And I have to say, back to Jim, that when I think about memory, there are plenty of us that are convinced, as women who see this, that if Blasey Ford had remembered every single detail of the assault, many of us believe that the outcome still would have been the same.
Hmm.
We have to call it as we see it. And so that can produce hopelessness, knowing that the shift in power and that the power differential, yes, there are abused men, but speaking to the issue for mainly women right now, that power differential has made us all wake up more than ever. And I know we've talked about our collective anger, our collective movements. And all of this is in motion right now. So absolutely, we're not just moving on.
Nor should we. We have not really dealt with this. If this is a representative of the world that we live in. Jim, any thoughts to what Astra and also Marla just said?
Yeah, I totally agree that even if she had remembered everything, it might not have changed the outcome. And I didn't. You know, I went into this trying to use it as an opportunity to educate people and speak some of the truth about trauma and memory from that scientific angle. But I wasn't under any illusions that would necessarily change things. But I did see it as an opportunity to educate people and to support and validate the experience of women around this country and around the world, but also men who've been assaulted and abused in various ways as well.
Well, and I do want to get to that, but I'm also picking up on what you were saying, Astra, about your patients and also about Dr. Blasey Ford herself, I've been thinking a lot about her. I mean, there she was, center stage. She had the morning to testify, and she was outed in many ways. I mean, this was not, I mean, maybe, who knows? Nonetheless, she was outed. It wasn't necessarily her idea to do this. Thinking about, so what is her life like now? I mean, how do you go back to a regular life after that?
From what I understand, she's still struggling with the aftermath of this testimony. And I think I've heard that she hasn't even been able to come back to her own home because of death threats. So the lingering stigma around being somebody who's willing to stand up and say, this happened to me, can last for a very, very long time. And that in and of itself is a heavy weight for clients or for survivors to carry.
Just because what do you do with it, right?
Right, right. Well, certainly, you know, counseling and therapy and seeking avenues of support where you can process through these experiences can be very, very helpful. But sometimes it's just kind of a matter of, you know, catching your breath and saying, maybe there isn't really a good resolution for this right now, right? I think one of the things that all of us are trying to do in this room right now is continue that conversation so that we don't move into a place of complacency around this issue and keep the conversation and the questions going.
Well, and Marla, I mean, it seems, it sort of goes without saying that a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing, is that the place to have this conversation? You're saying no, Astra. But,
I mean,
and people chose sides for all sorts of political and probably psychological reason.
I agree. I do want to back up and say absolutely to Jim, exploring memory and addressing the individual issues that are coming into all our offices is very, very important. You know, should this have all played out at the judicial level? Absolutely not. And that's just it. When we talk at a population level about stress and toxic stress, a lot of what's happening would have happened regardless in our country. That is, there are movements, the Me Too movement, other movements, where we all are learning and hopefully on a mission to be healing one another and ourselves individually. What's missing is a safe context in which to do it. So when a therapist sees an individual who's a victim of abuse, they are in a safe space, that office. The government in our country at a population level is failing to provide a safe space in which these conversations can happen.
What would a safe space on a more national, even global level, what would that look like?
That's a fantastic question. So a safe space means that this plays out and we expect stability from the highest office in the land, from our Senate and from our House, so that whether they agree or disagree, there is civility and conversation that allows differences to be heard and that they understand their role of protecting people so that we can move forward together. And we should be able to have radio shows, conversations, see our patients in our offices, deal with the science of memory, have all of these discussions, but in a space where we realize that the adults, I want to stress that, in charge, right, are not laughing at us. And I would even go so far as to say that the laughter that Blasey Ford described in her testimony, which is seared into all of our memories, that same laughter was in a bizarre way mirrored by members of the Judicial Committee. Hmm. And I think that
in a
really,
sense, laughing at her.
Yes,
and
therefore, because she represents so many women, devaluing many of us.
You're nodding your head. And then, Jim, I'll get you back in. Hold on one sec. Go ahead, Astra.
Yeah, I'm just nodding my head because I think one of the things that was so difficult about watching her testimony was that the individuals who were in the room questioning her did not have the education that we know they should have had to do this. And I love what Jim said about, you know, using this opportunity to advocate and teach around how the brain works. But it was very, very frustrating for me, and I know for many of my clients, to watch people who were so inept around this topic and not understand how the brain works and be able to bring that into the conversation at the same time that they were, you know, in the process of trying to hear her testimony. That was very, very frustrating and triggering.
Jim, do you want to speak to that? And we should say that the Republicans actually brought in a lawyer who specializes in some of the things we've been talking about. But nonetheless, Jim, go ahead.
Well, on this issue of, you know, what's a safe context and who's responsible for us not having one, certainly, you know, there's people in government who are failing us in that way. But also, I think there's a lot of failure going around. The media has not done a particularly good job. We're getting better in the Me Too movement, but the media could do a lot better in helping to create safe spaces. All of us could be less polarizing. I mean, there is so much demonization of people on both sides of the political divide. And a lot of people who are doing really important activist work on sexual assault can also, they're only human, they can fall into demonizing, condemning, shaming, wanting to punish and humiliate people who have committed these crimes and who are, you know, protecting them. And, you know, I just think that that's part of the problem too. Like, it's going to take all of us trying to find a way to respect the dignity of everybody involved, even people who commit these crimes, I mean, even people who protect them. Because if we don't do that, you know, we're going to continue to have this loss of civility and this undermining of our legitimacy of our institutions. It's very concerning to me, actually.
Well, Jim, I'm glad you raised that, because I have to say the men in my life, friends and colleagues, a number of them talking about the fact that while they didn't do what Kavanaugh is alleged to have done, they have regrets. There are things they wish they had not done that they did do, maybe push a little too hard. What do you think men should be thinking about or talking about?
Well, I think, you know, looking inside and looking into their past about the things they've done is very important. And maybe the men in your life are able to do that because they feel safer to do that. You know, some people who have the most power are also, as we see on a regular basis, also quite vulnerable, and they cling to power to try and protect themselves. And if accountability means public humiliation and destruction, then we're not going to find the men who have power really owning up to these things. I think it's a real dilemma. People need to be held accountable, but if we shame and humiliate them, or if that's what they're afraid of, it makes it all the harder for people to take responsibility for their behavior.
Let me go back to you, Astra. One thing you were telling Debbie Builder as part of a pre-interview is you feel like while many women can report if not being sexually assaulted, certainly feeling harassed or in some sense of danger, that the number of men who commit these acts is relatively discreet or small. I don't want to overstate it.
Right. So there's some research that comes out of David Lysak's work up in Boston around, looking at perpetrators. And one of the things that he found is that, you know, it's not all men who perpetrate these crimes, not by any means. But there are a small number of men who are repeat offenders. And then what we're looking at is really entrenched kind of perpetrator behavior. And this might be a little bit more along Jim's line of research and expertise. But I think we need to be very careful that we don't stigmatize men in general or throw them into some kind of a bucket. This is a very common experience for women. I would say the statistics are overwhelmingly on the side of most women experience this in some way. But that doesn't mean that most men are perpetrating it.
And Lysak was a mentor of mine, actually, and I did that research.
All the pieces are coming together very nicely.
Absolutely.
Talking with Jim Hopper, Astra Cherney, and Marla Gold about where to go from here as a result of the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing featuring testimony by both Brett Kavanaugh and Blasey Ford. And we are and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Well, I want to pick up on something you said, thinking about women who have felt, most women have felt some degree of vulnerability, I'll put it that way. And I was thinking about, even if you're a woman alone in a parking lot at night, I mean, there is that sense that something could happen. Even if it doesn't, there's this kind of awareness that I'm alone in a parking lot at night.
That's right. And I think to some extent, you'll find that the majority of women, the majority of us, feel that way, and that the movements that are going on right now, the Me Too movement, has sort of woke us all up about that. In other words, what we used to say, you know, walking safely at night, or what does it mean to be careful, we say it to our daughters. What are we really saying? We're becoming acutely aware of the potential, again, the power difference, and our own safety. And the trauma of Blasey Ford's testimony and how it affected those of us in the nation cannot be understated. I do agree, back to the safe space, completely about the media, role of media, role of politics, the constant barraging that we're all hearing. I refer to it in my office as sort of an uncivil war. We say we're not at civil war, but I believe there is the potential here for an uncivil war. And I do agree that we, as individuals, individually and collectively, have the power to create safer spaces for one another. What we're missing are role models. We're missing the kind of role models at the top, I'm talking about, who, again, can provide the structure.
Right.
And I think, in a way, that's uniting us all, and that's a good time.
Let me read some comments that we have here, an email from Sarah. She says, my book group met last week. 3 out of the 4 women have been sexually assaulted. The 4th had been sexually harassed by her boss at work. Just putting this out there. A comment from Danielle. Trauma impacts children's brains differently than adults. Dr. Ford was a child when this occurred, only 15. You want to speak to that, Astra?
Yeah, trauma in childhood, and again, Jim can speak to this as well, I think, it can disrupt developmental processes. And that doesn't necessarily mean that that's permanent. There are lots of ways that people can come back around from that and find healing and wholeness as a result of that. But yes, absolutely. When we experience childhood trauma or adolescent trauma, it's a very different kind of scenario than what happens to us when we experience it as adults.
Because our brains are, in a sense, fully formed, or we're just an older person.
Exactly. And in childhood, those processes are still in development.
Jim, you want to speak to that?
I think she said it very well. Yeah, the developing child and adolescent brain is still being shaped by experience and by culture and violent experiences like this. And then not just that, but how they are responded to. Someone like Dr. Blasey Ford, you know, she didn't tell anyone. You know, she didn't have, there wasn't a safe space for her that she felt to talk about this and to get support. And that's a layer of betrayal that institutions are putting on kids and adolescents around the country still, though we've gotten better, that if people don't feel safe telling someone about it and seeking help, that's another really traumatic thing that can shape people's brains very deeply when they're kids and adolescents. If not just are they harmed in this way, but there's not safe people to help them right. with it.
I mean, that, Marla, is a public health issue.
It is a public health issue, absolutely. And we come back to the way in which loads of people, as I've said in some studies, up to 80% of women reporting some form of harassment, that this kind of stress and then the memory of it that's happening. It's interesting, someone writing about the book club, me too, me too, me too, and people feeling that they're able to remember it and talk about it and the angle that took place. On the flip side, notice that there is something good to say about people beginning to create these spaces more for one another. That, you know, total people that you thought you knew about, your good friend, person in a book club, someone else tells the story, puts a hashtag MeToo on their social feed, and you're aware of just the numbers and how many people it's affected. Yeah. So we really are going to need more therapists, more systems, more safety. I do want listeners to envision, I think we need to envision together a world, a country, where people respect one another, regardless of their difference in opinion, and feel safe to walk anywhere. That's what we're working toward.
I want to pick up on that after this very short break, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about trauma and memory and the brain, how our brains process traumatic events, also what it takes to recover from trauma. And again, let me reintroduce our three guests. Marla Gold is Dean Emerita, Professor of Health Management and Policy at Drexel University here in Philadelphia. Spent her career focused on social justice and population health. Astra Cherney is Assistant Professor of Community and Trauma Counseling at Thomas Jefferson University, also here in Philadelphia. She's a counselor with a private practice in Jenkintown. And Jim Hopper joining us from the studios of Harvard University, teaching associate in psychology at Harvard Medical School and a nationally recognized expert on psychological trauma. Lots of calls and comments coming in. 1-888-477-9499. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Esther, I want to put this to you, but I'm sure Jim and Marla want to weigh in on this as well. Some people are able, for probably a whole host of reasons, to be able to deal with a trauma and are not as traumatized as other people are. Are there certain factors that make some people more vulnerable than others?
There are definitely factors that impact how people respond to trauma. And resilience is one of those factors. That's kind of something that I think a lot of people are looking at right nowadays. You know, how do we develop resilience? Where does it come from? But other things play into it as well. When, you know, people who are well-connected, who have loving, supportive relationships, where they do actually have a sense that they can go to that person and talk about what happened to them, is a huge factor that mitigates the impact of trauma. Individuals who grow up in families where they're not believed or in communities where they're not believed, where they're ostracized or stigmatized in any way, are going to be much more negatively impacted by trauma. So some of this really speaks to the community aspect of it, right? How do we as a community hold victims or survivors of these types of crimes in our hearts and in our arms, right? And how do we facilitate the healing process rather than adding to it?
Jim, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I agree with everything she said, that you know, people really need supportive relationships, they need supportive communities, they need supportive institutions. I mean, one of the things we've been hearing about so much over the last year is all these institutions that are themselves dangerous places to be. You know, we've heard of Hollywood and all the sexual assaults and harassment going on there. We hear about it in the media, the Catholic Church. You know, so there's many institutions, and that has profound impacts on people's bodies and brains to be in institutional systems where people are committing these acts against others with impunity, and those who are vulnerable are not being supported, not being believed. It has huge effects on people's brains, including not just PTSD, but depression and demoralization and people feeling beaten down and defeated. And that's a biological process as well.
And for the body, what does that feel like?
Well, to feel beaten down, I mean, people feel heavy. They feel hopeless. They feel like they don't feel motivated to try and change things. What's the point? You know, all those heavy, hopeless feelings that go with depression.
Marla, you want to add to what we were talking about?
You know, ditto on connection. Connection is a key. It's normally a key, and in these times that we're in, it's a very important link to us surviving, not only surviving, but thriving. And that is what we're looking for. These are cumulative wounds of abuse and inequality, and we have to really grab onto one another and ride this wave of time together. On the good side, I think that we're seeing a lot of that happening. These movements, focused anger, which can be a great tool to get through this time, moving toward change, working in local neighborhoods, staying connected to others is key.
Do we need a Truth and Reconciliation Commission? Are we at that point, Marla?
Do we need a Truth and Reconciliation Commission? I mean, on one hand, we do, but I think that we can do that together in our population, in these movements that we have. And I think that's what we're doing. Cannot stress enough that this need for safe space from our institutions, not to stop these discussions, but to create the space in which they can take place in a civil way, is so important to our ability to thrive.
Let me get Jim, did you want to add something to that?
Yeah, I think, you know, often in the media and even among a lot of trauma folks, you know, when we talk about the brain and trauma, people are always talking about the amygdala and fear. But this circuitry of seeking is really important too. It's part of the reward circuitry. It's what are we seeking in our day-to-day lives? And traumatized people are often just seeking to escape from their suffering, escape from their fear, and they're trying to escape in ways that aren't really healing them. And I think what Marla is talking about and Astra is, you know, how do we help people seek to engage with their suffering in safe ways and really heal it, and even use a Christian term, to redeem it, you know, to actually turn toward their suffering and seek healing. And then also to really seek out things that are really good for them, seek out things that are good for our society, like democratic engagement and creating institutions that do support the vulnerable. So I think it's not just about fear and dealing with that. It's about what are we seeking here? What are we valuing? And how do we support each other to seek to turn toward trauma and heal it in safe ways and seek out those things that are really good for ourselves and our families and our communities and our society?
Esther, I know you want to weigh in, and then we'll get some callers, and I've got lots more comments
as well.
Well,
I just wanted to say something about the redemption conversation, and I think that, you know, I don't know if I have the answer to that, and I don't know if Marla or Jim has the answer for that either, but kind of keep asking that question, I think, is really important. And it's not necessarily about, you know, everybody has to confess or anything in that line, but taking a personal inventory of our own behaviors, not any differently than we would around racism or oppression, right? That we have to acknowledge that in some ways we, you know, especially individuals in power, are part of that system, and then take some steps on a personal level to move ourselves into a place of more tolerance and acceptance and understanding. I think that's a really important part of this conversation as well.
Do that kind of inventory and own
absolutely.
It, right? And
absolutely.
Own it. Let me get Deborah from Wynwood to join our conversation. And Deborah, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I'm just, yes. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a 53-year-old assault survivor of sexual assault. It was actually right around St. Joseph's University's campus back in the early 80s. And it was with a stranger. I had no idea who it was. I was just taken away from an ATM. But over the course of 30 years or so, I find that I've detached so much that it's almost as if it happened to somebody else at this point.
Wow.
The Blasey Ford testimony actually really woke up a lot of what I had buried. And I've had many opportunities to talk. My parents are fortunately a psychiatrist and a psychoanalyst. But It really took me to a place that I have not been for such a long time. It really scraped open the wound, the emotions. I was really shaken up, you know, for a week after that. I'm okay now, but I think that's probably happened to people all across the country, you know, everybody watching all this unfold.
Sure. Well, first of all, Deborah, I'm so sorry. We're all so sorry, of course, what happened to you in the early 1980s, but also so grateful that you called into the show. And I'm actually looking back at Astrid because she deals with probably people like yourself, Deborah.
Absolutely. And so this story of disconnection from self in order to survive, these are really effective survival mechanisms. But at some point, I think, you know, really facing what has happened to somebody in a way that facilitates moving past it can be helpful. I'm so glad that you called in and shared your story. This is so powerful for so many people who are listening today to be able to hear that you had the courage to call in and say, this was really difficult for me to hear, and it opened a wound that I thought I had closed.
Right, but also feeling some degree of hope from Deborah as well.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Jim, anything you want to say in response to Deborah?
Yeah, just it's totally normal what you're going through, and we can have these horrible experiences that are, you know, deeply burned into our brains, but then we can push them away, try to escape from them, and, you know, that can go on for many years, but just because we haven't remembered something for a long time doesn't mean that it's not, you know, deeply etched into our brain, and that in certain circumstances, like, you know, so many women like you and millions around this country have experienced with this Blasey Ford situation, it can really open those wounds, and those old painful memories and all the emotions that go with them can just come bursting forth.
Yeah.
It's so important that we are having these kind of conversations and supporting folks like you.
Deborah, thanks so much for calling into Radio Times. A question from one of our listeners. Do you have any advice for the partners of people who have experienced sexual assault who were re-traumatized by the hearings? And this would be maybe someone revealing for the first time of something that happened to them. I'm looking at you, Marla. If there's anything you want to say, I'm going to go back to you, Astra.
I think, you know, connection. Right. So people who are in relationship with individuals who suddenly disclose, you know, believe that person, be supportive of that person, and help that person find avenues for healing. And healing is very possible from this type of trauma. And I'm not saying that to minimize the trauma in any way, but healing is definitely possible. And so I often tell clients, like, there's really not a reason for you to suffer to this degree. There are definitely interventions that can help mitigate the impact of trauma on clients.
What's one?
Well, there are many, and I don't want to advocate for just any one. I am a certified EMDR therapist, which is eye movement desensitization reprocessing, and that has shown to be very effective for trauma of many different kinds, like all kinds of trauma. It's also very respectful of the client, and the client is kind of in charge of that process, which in and of itself can be very empowering.
Yeah.
But there are lots of other interventions as well that are out there, and so you just have to do your homework and find a good match for you.
Can I add a little to this?
You sure can, Jim. Go ahead.
Sure. So, yeah, Astra was just articulating it at the heart of EMDR, which I've also done research on, is this real respect for the person who's trying to heal or wants to heal, and a real respect for them doing it at their own pace and giving them options to choose from. And a beautiful thing about EMDR is people don't even have to talk about it in order to transform that memory. They can process it without having to put it into words. And sometimes talking about it can make it harder to process it because all these beliefs and things we have. And so at the center of healing from trauma and also seeking justice is we really need to empower the survivor to make their own decisions and choices. And we need to really be connected with them, as Marla was saying. And so for partners as well, when someone you love tells you that they've been assaulted or they've been abused, it stirs up a lot of feelings in you, and it's natural to want to fix it, you know, to have a lot of fear and aversion and you want to fix it. And what can happen is then you can push your partner to do something to heal it. On the one hand, you want to help them. On the other hand, you're just trying to manage your own distress. Mm-hmm. And so really to seek help in dealing with your own distress and what that triggers in you, then you're going to be much more able to support your partner to make their own choices while feeling connected to you about what's going to be healing. Because if you're pushing them or trying to control them, even with good intentions, that's not going to be very helpful.
Let me read another comment. The hearings were were led by all white men, although there were some women, Democratic women and women of color, I should say, or at least a man and a woman of color. But nonetheless, the hearings were led by all white men who don't have sensitivity for the Me Too movement or women who have been sexually assaulted. I'm a lawyer and have represented women who have been assaulted. They didn't handle it the right way. Can I toss that to you, Marla?
Yeah, I mean, it absolutely appeared that from the science that we're hearing about today, that we had a largely uninformed judicial body who didn't understand the science. We expect, and I think incorrectly so, we expect our leaders to have the science when they're in these proceedings. And I have to add that we expect our leaders to believe in science. It's important, and it's hard not to get political when we're dealing with what's happened in the past few weeks. So that just adds insult to injury. And, you know, feeling connected and understanding that this is something that not only happened to one person, but is something that has happened to the majority of us, and therefore we can pull ourselves together and be connected to come out of it, is critical.
I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let me read a question from Ruth. She says, my mother was a victim of sexual assault, and her memory worked differently than Dr. Ford's, so she didn't believe her. But don't memories and experiences vary from person to person? Is it even fair to compare? Jim, can I toss that to you?
Yeah, there's certainly differences in how people experience things and encode them and store them and remember them later between people. But there are commonalities, too. Even someone who says, oh, I remember everything about it. They don't remember everything. We don't remember everything about any experience. But they may have remembered more about what the context was, where they went afterwards, and things like that. So there may be ways that their memory seems very different than Dr. Blasey Ford's. But I would guess if we had time to sit down and talk with her mother about what she remembered, that there would be more similarities than differences, though there, of course, can be differences as well.
You want to add to that, Esther?
Yeah, I think it's interesting that she had a hard time believing Dr. Blasey Ford. But that you know, in the end, I think I can only reiterate what Jim said. You know, there are lots of different ways to encode memory, and there are lots of different ways to respond to your own traumatic experience. And sometimes we respond in a way that, you know, pushes others away, and we don't necessarily develop a sense of compassion for others who have experienced similar things. But that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, her experience or anybody else's experience is invalid. I think we need to understand that there are lots of different ways to respond to these experiences and make space for those responses and continue to work with those responses and make sure that we're helping in the best way possible.
Jim, we're almost out of time, and I'm just curious about, are we still learning about the brain and trauma and memory?
Yes, we are definitely still learning. I mean, there's some things that are pretty well known, and now we're working out the details, but we're definitely still learning. If I could say one thing about the racial issue that was brought up,
yes.
I think that, you know, in our culture, we have a conception of punitive justice. If someone does something wrong, did they do it, and what's the punishment going to be? And for a long time in our culture and politically, there's been a lot of support for that if it's applied to poor black and brown young men who are involved in drug crimes and violence of different sorts. But when it's white men in power and white college students who are committing sexual assaults, it becomes very uncomfortable to people in power to think about applying punitive justice to them. And so I think there is this real racial dimension that kind of justice to poor brown people, it's not so acceptable to poor white people. And we're really going to have to grapple with that as we grapple with this Me Too era.
I appreciate you adding that to our conversation. Jim Hopper, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Jim. Teaching associate in psychology at Harvard Medical School. His blog is Sexual Assault and the Brain. Esther Journey, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times as well.
You're so welcome.
And Esther Journey is an assistant professor of community and trauma counseling at Thomas Jefferson University. Again, she has a private practice in Jenkintown. And Marla Gold, thank you for coming in as well.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. She's Dean Emerita, professor of health management and policy at Drexel University. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you for joining us.